You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, talks with Iran regarding its nuclear programme intensify ahead of tomorrow's deadline. The latest report suggests all sides are locked in stalemate after days of negotiations. Then...
But let me be clear about one other thing. Our long-term future lies inside, not outside, the European Union.
British Labour leader Ed Miliband there. The campaign for the May 7th general election begins officially today, and the vote itself may prove to be the most unpredictable for decades. In France, the Socialist Party's been crushed by Nicolas Sarkozy's centre-right party at local elections, while the far-right Front National made only limited gains. And in Australia, world leaders' private details have been accidentally sent to the organisers of the Asian Cup football tournament. We'll ask why and how. I'll be joined by Tim Marshall and Sebastian Borger to discuss these and the day's other big news stories. That's ahead on Midori House, with me, Tom Edwards, here on Monocle 24. Welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. My guests today are Sebastian Borger, correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and Tim Marshall, formerly a diplomatic editor at Sky News and founder of thewhatandthewhy.com. Let's start today's show with Iran's nuclear talks. In Lausanne, the negotiations on the future of Iran's nuclear programme have continued for days. According to the latest reports, both sides are locked in a stalemate a day before tomorrow's self-imposed deadline. Sebastian, perhaps I'll start with you. We've sort of gone down to the proverbial wire once again. Should we be surprised that that's the way these talks have headed?
No, certainly not. I mean, this has been going on for about 10 years now, and there are constant wires in the way, aren't there? And then there's a little bit of progress, and then there's a little bit of stepping back, and the odd Iranian nuclear scientist is murdered by we know who, and all that. I think it sounds, I mean, who knows, but it sounds as if they actually have now reached some agreement on some of the issues, at least. But I mean, they're quite rightly, I think, all the Western powers that are involved are quite rightly saying, well, we need the complete package, because we've too often made deals on single issues with the Iranians, and they weren't kept. So I think that's probably a good tactic.
Tim, that's an interesting point, isn't it? And I wonder to what degree, you know, the Iranian delegates at this sort of meeting are slightly hamstrung. You know, do they have the political facility to make that kind of no strings attached arrangement, or is that not even, can they not even bring that to the table in the first place?
That's one of the reasons why they go on and on and on, because every single centrifuge that they agree to give up, they then have to get onto a secure line back to Tehran and ask the guys who are really in charge, can we give up that one centrifuge? When you're thinking they're talking about thousands of centrifuges, that's why it takes so long. As I understand it, they really are down to the last couple of problems. And my problem with the deal, as I understand it, is that Obama set out to get the Iranians to agree to only having 1,500 centrifuges to spin. So that would give an absolute minimum of 1 year breakout to build a nuclear bomb. If you decide, right, we don't care, we're going for it, it would take about a year. The Iranians have got him up to 6,000. And he appears to be agreeing, okay, you can have up to 6,000. And the only sticking points, as I understand it, is the amount of research and development that the Iranians can do into getting more modern centrifuges. They're arguing, we're a sovereign state, why can't we have technology to look into the future? You could argue that's a fair point. And also, when are you going to lift all the sanctions? We want them immediately. Now, I think both of those points are salvageable or soluble. So they're very, very close. If they get a deal that enough people think is a bad deal, you will see the Israelis begin to rattle the saber, but you will also see the Saudis and others starting to look into their own nuclear technology.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point, isn't it, Sebastian? I mean, how much do you think there's sort of elephant in the room, if you want to use that sort of cliche, is the nations who are not present at these talks? Is it as much about the response from the Saudis, from the Israelis, to what's decided, what's thrashed out in Lausanne, as it is about what happens around that table?
Well, I thought that was the reason why we've been sitting around those tables for the last 10 years, because we quite rightly fear that the Saudis and Turkey and all sorts of other, the Egyptians, draw their own conclusions and want their own bomb. I mean, Pakistan managed it without much sanctions. So that's always part of the deal. And I mean, the saber rattling from Israel has in truth already started. I mean, whatever deal you make with Iran will be followed by an extreme saber rattling. The question is how serious Mr. Netanyahu then is about it.
And he hasn't burnt his bridges with Obama, but he's damaged them. There's only 600 days left of the Obama presidency, and I think he's gambled on that I will go with the American public and to Congress and tell them what a bad deal is. And, you know, even if it means that I'm not going to have a friendly relationship with Obama. I mean, I think they have to do some sort of business together. But again, what is also behind this, and Sebastian's alluded to it, is the wider region. It's not even just nukes. If there's the grand bargain, as it's called, between the Iranians and the Americans, because the Americans have got bigger fish to fry elsewhere, that the Arab states fear that leaves the Iranians in a position of being the dominant power, and they will start to creep ever westward. And that's what they're all concerned about. But as I said, I think the deal is close. Kerry cancelled a flight back to Washington yesterday. He stayed on. They only do that if they think they've got a chance.
Let me just pick up on what you said about that calculation or miscalculation, perhaps, from Netanyahu when it comes to what's happening on Capitol Hill. Was that a calculated gamble? Has he miscalculated? I don't know.
By Bibi?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. He did a number of things in the run-up to the election, and he got increasingly desperate. One, he went to Congress knowing he would burn the bridges partially with Obama, but he's desperate to get re-elected. And I think he's actually genuine in what he says about Iran. Whether he's right or wrong is another issue. He then said the Arabs are voting in droves. I mean, that was a pretty desperate thing to say.
Desperate is a polite word for what it is.
And then he also said that I'm not going to have a two-state solution, which again showed you how desperate. So I think those three things showed you how desperate he was to win power. Now that he has won power, he can backtrack on all of them if he chooses. And I think he will backtrack. Well, he already has backtracked on the two-state solution, and he has more or less apologized for the Arabs are voting in droves remark, but he will not backtrack on the Iranian issue for two reasons. One, in case they ever do get a bomb, that's an existential threat. But secondly, even if they don't get a bomb, if they get an agreement, they become the dominant power in the Middle East. They've already got the Republican Guard on the Israeli border in Syria.
Now, especially without sort of putting you on the spot and saying, you know, is this going to be wrapped up, you know, today or tomorrow or in time by these deadlines? Do you think we'll see I don't know what to describe it as, a workable solution coming out of Lausanne? If Kerry's cancelled his flights, as Tim suggests, then, you know, it does appear to be a little closer. Will it be workable? Will it be something practical that we can actually look at and say, you know, that was a worthwhile enterprise?
My hunch is yes. And I can't see an alternative. I mean, we talk about Iran getting the bomb. Well, Israel has had the bomb for decades. I know it's a democracy and Iran isn't. But on the other hand, we've got to try and deal with Iran in a constructive manner. And I think that's what we have been doing.
My instinct is we don't know and it might fall apart. But I think the Iranians at the moment are thinking this is the best deal we'll ever get with Obama in the office. We've got X, Y, and Z. We can afford to give them a couple of things back to try and nail it down. But I mean, we're 24 hours away from knowing.
Let's leave the Iran nuclear talks there for now and continue with the results of France's local elections. The far-right Front National made limited gains. The biggest winner appeared to be former President Nicolas Sarkozy and his centre-right UMP party, which together with its allies has won at least 66 local councils in the second round of voting. It seems the comeback of Sarko has been confirmed. He's enjoying a lot more popular support. People are talking about a possible run at the 2017 elections. Sebastian, is this Vive Le Sarko? Is he back in the front rank of French politics?
It certainly looks like it, doesn't it? And we'll all have lots of fun with the fidgety man, particularly Angela Merkel, who always hated being touched up by him. But you know, it's not so much the strength of Sarkozy; it's the terrible weakness of the president François Hollande. I mean, you see a middle-ranking supermarket manager in front of you, not a president, and the French people clearly are fed up of him and his party.
I mean, that's a pretty damning indictment. Tim, do you think that people talk a little bit about this sort of, you know, crisis for European socialism, this sort of thing? I mean, it may be too early to talk about that in a wide sense, but this is demonstrative of a problem that Hollande and his ilk are having, not just in France, perhaps.
Well, the fracturing of the vote is something, and we can come on to it, the UK election is something that is across the continent. I think absolutely.
Not in Germany.
No, yeah, you have, well, we were talking earlier, I think Germany is the most democratic and vibrant nation in the continent at the moment, but let's put that to one side. Sorry, just going back to the figures, the UMP went from 41 council, which they controlled, to 65. The socialists dropped from 60 down to 34. It's a wipeout for Hollande and the socialists. Puts him in a terrible position for the next presidency, and I'm absolutely certain Sarkozy will go for it. Now, the Front National. There's two ways of looking at it. There were 4,108 seats up for grabs. They won 62.
From a very low base, we should also say.
But that's the point, isn't it? Mm. So did they do very badly because they didn't get any councils and they were thinking we might even be able to control a council or two? So it's a defeat for the Front National. But at the same time, in 2011, they got one seat. Now they've got 62 seats. So the trajectory is for the growth of the Front National, the splintering of the vote. And the only reason they didn't win councils is because the left and right came together in the second round to vote to make sure that they didn't get in. They are still there, and it is problematic in any country where you have 25% of the electorate which supports the Front National, which they did in the first round, 25%, and no councils. They feel marginalised, that the system's wrong. When you get people, that amount of people, a quarter of the electorate who think that the system is wrong, they will try and change that system. And you know, I think it's both a win for the Front National in terms of voter support, but a loss that they didn't break through into seats.
Sebastian, what do you think the reason behind that is? Is it a failure on behalf of Marine Le Pen to cement that kind of support? Or do you think it's a display of some sort of pragmatism from, you know, the French electorate or the moderate French electorate in the centre and to the left to sort of resist what seemed at some times almost like an inexorable rise from the Front National?
It reminds us of the 2002 presidential election, doesn't it? Where
you'll have to remind me of that.
Marine's father,
oh yes,
Jean-Marie Le Pen, yeah, actually caused the sensation.
Went through to the second round.
And went through to the second round. And then Chirac wiped the floor with him. Because, again, the moderate conservative voters, the socialist voters supported
but
the
moderate. But that just deals with the electoral necessity of Chirac making sure he gets in and the moderate element in France uniting. It doesn't deal with why there are 25% of the country votes for what is essentially a fascist party. So it doesn't actually deal with the underlying causes. But it simply keeps them out of power.
Is that about a shift, though, Tim, towards the right, or is it about an electorate that's so chronically dissatisfied, yes, with what it's seeing in the Élysée Palace that it's desperate to reach out to anything, or is it a bit of both?
It's a bit of both, but still the issues are not dealt with, of unemployment, the problems of immigration, racial tensions. I mean, it's all just still swirling around there in France, and France has not got the best record in the Western Europe of being a nice, gentle, moderate country.
But can I just say, I mean, the French voters know their system very well. They didn't vote. I mean, as you're quite right.
25% of them did.
Yes, hang on. In the first round,
yes,
knowing that there would be a second round. Now, in the second round, I haven't seen the percentages, but it's clearly quite a lot lower, isn't it?
Indeed.
So that's like the European elections, where people constantly vote for all sorts of jokers, like UKIP here in Britain, knowing that there's no influence connected with that vote. Now, let's see in Britain, the interesting thing, but also in France, let's see if push comes to shove, if there is actual power to be handed out, whether they still support the Front National, who, by the way, I'm not entirely sure whether we can dismiss them as a fascist party. I mean, no, that, there are clearly
she
elements
has,
of that.
Yeah, Marine Le Pen. I mean, I lived in France during the Jean-Marie Le Pen years.
That was a fascist party.
Yes, I was held up against a wall, I remember, covering a Front National demo. By several thugs in leather jackets who demanded to see my passport. Now, the Front National of today, most of their supporters and security would not behave like that. She has gone a long, long way, and I...
They'd be wearing a blazer, at least.
And a striped tie, if they were British.
It's an interesting point, though. And I wonder, looking with the sort of the German perspective, we sort of talk jokingly about Frau Merkel's view of Sarko. But what do the Germans make of, you know, the rise of someone like Marine Le Pen, and the fact that she does appear, even if it is that sort of almost protest vote that you're describing there in the first round, she does appear to have galvanised a worryingly large proportion of the French population.
Well, it's very clearly the same problem that we have in Germany, that a lot of the working class, a lot of people who struggle in life, have lost confidence in the big political parties.
Very much so.
That's the same with our Social Democrats, who can't get out of the ghetto of 25%, 26%, 27% anymore, and a lot of people. Used to not vote, who now have found an outlet in these protest parties, which in our case is the so-called Alternative for Germany, which now gets 10-12% as well. And 10 years ago, it was the neo-fascists who got roughly the same amount of vote in regional elections. Again, you know, I think if it's really about the important power, people think twice.
We'll be talking about the important power plays here in the UK. Starters' orders in the UK election. That race will be up for discussion next. Tim Marshall and Sebastian Borger are staying with me here on Midori House.
From the streets of Kabul to a girls' school in the shadow of the Hindu Kush, London-based artist George Butler spent 3 weeks in Afghanistan reporting on life in the war-torn country through that most old-fashioned of methods, paper and ink.
This is in Herat. And as always, I just picked a spot that I thought I could describe what I was witnessing as best as I could. It's very much that balance in Afghanistan of how long it's safe to be there, but also that drive to try and describe to people what it's like in a place that is almost always described as dangerous or unsafe.
Art of War, a Monocle film, now playing on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards. Still with me are Tim Marshall and Sebastian Borger. Now, here in the UK, Prime Minister David Cameron has announced the official start of the campaign for the May 7th general election. The year's contest could prove to be one of the most unpredictable for many years. The latest poll suggests none of the major parties will win an outright majority, and the winner would be dependent on the assistance of smaller parties in order to form a government. Certain themes likely to dominate on the campaign trail include Britain's EU membership, the economy, of course, cuts in spending, and immigration, regrettably, in some quarters. Sebastian, let me start with you. What's your analysis of the big themes here, but particularly from a German point of view? I know that this notion, which is always chimed by all the party leaders around this time, of solutions for hard-working families, is something that you find slightly, I don't know, mystifying, perhaps?
I love that, yes, because I find in English literature, marvelous examples of people who do absolutely nothing and have a great time of it. You know, Toby Belch in Shakespeare's What You Want, or The Three Men in a Boat. And now I'm constantly bombarded with this slogan of hardworking, not just hardworking people, I mean, that's bad enough, but hardworking families. Yep. I just think, for heaven's sake, guys. No, you work hard and then you have a family, and I hope you have some downtime with your family. I mean, you chillax like the Prime Minister apparently does. That's very odd. Now, look, I don't envy the British people their choice this time. I think it's not the marvelously big alternative for a generation that people talk about. But there are clear differences, David Cameron has proven to be a reasonable prime minister who thinks, in my view, too tactically, too often, and at Miliband, I think, won't get rid of the millstone of having murdered his brother. Politically.
We should add. Tim, let me just ask you about this, because we sort of long prided ourselves in this country that the sort of peculiarities of the first-past-the-post system, they may not have been representative, but it was very good at delivering stable governments. Now, certain people within Westminster who sort of look to Europe and say, well, you know, you don't want these sorts of grand coalitions and constant chopping and changing. But somehow our system that we've trusted seems to have been undermined. I wonder, has it been undermined by a collective apathy?
No. Mm-mm. It's been undermined by the two major parties themselves, who have not listened to the electorate, have become so far removed from the electorate, also the death of ideology to an extent. So it's the two major parties' fault that people have disengaged. And how to get them back is a generational problem. I'm pretty sure the Conservatives will be the largest party in the next, 37 days' time. But whether they can then cobble together a coalition is another matter. I think the British electorate is now getting used to the idea of a coalition. We're so less tribal than we used to be. When I was a kid, you were one or the other from birth to death. You know, if you were 1 year old, you were Labour or whatever you were.
But
is that a more profound
change? It doesn't seem to just be about the two parties losing touch with their core demographics or people becoming disillusioned with the sort of adversarial nature of politics. That reflects a more profound change, doesn't it? It's a bigger shift in society. Mm. Is it the fact that the middle class is bigger than ever? Or I wonder what you attribute that towards.
Well, the middle class is bigger, and so there's less ideology around, because, you know, you haven't got workers of the world unite. The ideology has gone. It's just who's best at managing a country. Not leading it, but managing it. And it's very hard to get excited about management. Well, except in certain occasions. So I just think that we haven't got pygmies for leaders, but we don't have those great beasts, people that could attract you, people that had belief in their core and that spoke to you. So that's gone. Also, the Cold War has gone. So on foreign policy, I mean, wrongly, people
coming
think
back.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, oh, very much. Well, I think it's back, but people disagree with me. But last thing I'll go out on the limb on, and that is that the majority of this country, I think it's 92%, remains white. Now, the white working class, what remains of it, feels utterly betrayed by both parties, but particularly feels betrayed by Labour. And it feels that the white working class, I mean, obviously I haven't met every single one of them and asked them, but that nobody listens to them, no one takes any notice of them. And in fact, the political class, and in fact, there's a very strong strain in this country of snobbism, actually disdains them and thinks of them as at the bottom of the pile. They're not, but thinks of them in that way. And the white working class, I think, are the ones who are the most disengaged and think a plague on both your parties.
There's a question, and if people are perceived, if there's a perception that people in Westminster are being disdainful towards, you know, this large majority that Tim's identified there, should we be looking for, you know, the next breakout party, whether it's a UKIP or is it another fringe organisation, maybe that's further to the right, you know, that has even more unsavoury sort of populist rhetoric? Should we be concerned that that's an obvious consequence of that sort of disengagement?
Well, I think for a start, I'd be a little more positive about the new parties who are around. The Lib Dems have got their distinctive niche.
They're about to be wiped out.
Wiped out.
I mean, votes are going to fall in half, but go on.
Yes, they had, because they had a lot of votes from disillusioned Labour voters last time, 22%, and they'll end up with 8 to 10, but they'll still have about 25 to 30 seats in Parliament.
Yes.
So, you know, the SNP has managed something which I admire, even though I'm not keen on their breaking up the United Kingdom. That's the Scottish National Party in Scotland. And UKIP, you know, I was very unpleasant to them earlier, but they have engaged parts of that working, disillusioned working class.
They don't look down their noses.
Was talking about.
I mean, I'm not, you know, leave to one side the rights and wrongs. I'm not talking about whether they're right or wrong, but they take seriously the British white working class.
But are they
Tom,
just,
can, very briefly,
but are they,
I
just wonder, are they just better at the politics, though? Have they learned that we've moved on and they're better at communicating? You talk about it being a management game. Are they good managers rather than good politicians? Does it matter if there's a difference?
Well, they are pretty much a one-man band, and he does appeal, and what he says and the way he behaves appeals. I think they're going to get 3 or 4 seats at least, and then we'll see if they die or grow. Very briefly, Tom, you did talk about the rise of extremes. We tend not to do extremes in this country. We never really have done since we cut off the king's head 4 centuries ago. This is not a dig at Sebastian whatsoever, but in Germany and France, there are long histories over the past few hundred years of going to extremes. And we've never had that, and I don't believe that's where we're going. But there is a fracturing, and unless people's concerns are addressed, that fracturing will continue. I quite like the two-party system. I think it does deliver stability, but I think it's over for a few years.
You had 5 years of a marvelously stable government with the coalition. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. No. I think we're going to get used to coalitions.
There we go. We'll get used to coalitions.
By the way, see any troops on the street? No one's in charge. Parliament's been dissolved. There's no MPs. There's no. But it's all right. Everyone's calm. We're British.
Let's leave the UK scene there for a moment and look to Ukraine. Interestingly, one of the more concrete offers of support for that embattled country came today from the Hungarian-born American business magnate George Soros. He announced he's ready to invest $1 billion in the country, provided the West promises to help it. Sebastian, what are your thoughts about this offer? I know you spoke to George Soros recently.
I
wonder what, you know, where does a sort of a grand philanthropic plan end and a bit of grandstanding begin?
Well, that's very hard to tell and has been for years. But to be fair to him, his Open Society foundations have worked in the former Soviet Empire for 25 years now and have done lots of good things, I would have thought, from our perspective anyway. Don't ask Putin about that. But again, he's clearly linking, and I'm not sure whether some of the reports were quite accurate, he's clearly linking his offer of investing $1 billion with clear guarantees. He is very strong on saying the European Union has to engage much more and has to try and turn Ukraine into the West Berlin, or into a new West Berlin, and to demonstrate to the Russian people that we're not against Russia, we are against Putin's revisionism. And I think he's got a very strong point there.
Tim, just briefly on this, can you invest your way out of problems like this? You mentioned the sort of, we're back in the midst of a sort of Cold War situation. Do you think that's sustainable?
You can invest, because without investment and prosperity, you're never going to get anywhere, but it's no good just investment. There needs to be other things, political reform. What I would say, I'm trying to think of, a storm in a teacup. I'm trying to think of what's less than a storm in a teacup, and this is a mild breeze in a bowl of soup. Look, a $1 billion, which he may or may not give, well, the IMF gave them $40 billion. Just a couple of months ago. It is only political. I remember back in Serbia, he used to fund the opposition groups that eventually helped to overthrow Milosevic. He is simply someone who does not like what I regard as the Russian Empire, and you call it the Soviet Empire. For me, they're interchangeable. And he will continue as long as he lives to push back against that sort of revisionism. And it's a political gesture more than anything.
Now, I wanted before the end of the show just to ask you both very briefly about the Australian Department of Immigration accidentally leaking personal details of a number of world leaders who attended the G20 summit, Putin, Obama, David Cameron. All their info was sent to the Asian Cup football tournament and didn't let anyone know that this had happened. Very briefly, Tim, again, is this a storm in a teacup? Should we be worried? What bad could come of this, really?
It's a storm in a teacup. The only serious side to it is that they should have told these world leaders that anyone can, well, that their passport numbers had got out, but they only got out to a very closed circle. I hope they're all changing their passwords. I believe Merkel's is 123, and I think she's going for 1234 now.
Sebastian, in a word or two, should we worry about this, or is it something that we can just have a bit of
I just
about?
Commiserate with a poor person who did that. Not a very nice place to be in. I can't take it seriously.
No.
That is all we have time for on today's programme. Sebastian Borger and Tim Marshall, thanks both very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. Our producer today was Marcus Hippi. The show was researched by Fernanda Augusto Pacheco, Mike Hewin and Sarah Moneta. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next hour, more great music coming your way. And at 1900, don't forget to join Robert Bound for this week's edition of Culture. The Monocle Daily, more analysis of all the big stories of the day. Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds in the chair for that one. This show's back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London, 1300 in New York. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.